Welcome to another futuristic episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts, Andrew, David, and Jen. This week, we read Camelot 3000 by Mike Barr and Brian Boland. And now, the cast begins. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 113th episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with Jen.
Hey.
And David.
Hey.
This week we read Camelot 3000 by Mike W. Barr with art from Brian Boland. So it's from 1982. It's 12 issues of maxi series goodness.
Did you do an on theme adjective?
I don't think I did.
That's okay, continue.
I don't know, I couldn't think of an adjective.
Okay, I forgive you.
Okay, thank you. So what did you guys... Okay, I'm going to preface this. I wrote one of my biggest and best papers of my entire college, way too long academic career on this thing, and I love this comic to death. I'm just going to put that out there. So I'm playing the fanboy here, but I want to know how you guys felt about this.
I felt like this was really brave.
Yeah.
Because, first off, when you take any traditional myth, you have a chance of, really stirring people's ire. Mm-hmm. And second, they put in, they dealt with a lot of tricky things, especially with Tristan or, how Arthur handles adultery the second time around, mm-hmm. the role of women in the round table, mm-hmm. and politics and stuff. So it was a risk that they took, and I definitely respect that.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, I don't remember what the political and social climate was in 1985, but I can't imagine it was that much different from today's. So yeah, I totally agree with you, Jen. This must have been a pretty bold comic when it, when it hit the newsstands, right?
Yeah, and I mean, you got to consider from the point of view of the 1980s, this is even more bold, because as much as you think about how Tristan and the fact that he's reincarnated into this body and all that, that's fine. But on the surface, if you take away the reincarnation aspect of it, this is basically probably one of comics' first transgender characters. Right? I mean, I can't even think of any others that are out there today. Let alone 20 years ago. Shit, this is 30 years ago.
Yeah, I can't think of anything.
The closest thing I can even think of is, Phoenix sometimes possesses women and sometimes possesses men. But yeah, that's the only thing.
And you can get around that because the Phoenix isn't gendered. The Phoenix is just an entity, but Tristan was gendered, and Tristan is gendered.
Tristan was, super gendered. I want to point out that mustache.
Oh, the...
my God.
When he got the male facade for a couple seconds.
Yeah.
That was...
Well, even, the classical story of Tristan and Isolde. Is that how you pronounce that?
Isolde.
Yeah, Isolde.
Right?
Isolde, I forget. We read this long. I took the same class with Andy when he wrote that paper, I should remember.
Hey.
But that was, He was a very much a, it was a traditional Middle English love story, right? So
yeah,
gender roles were clearly defined there, and to mm-hmm. put a spin on it like this is, I'd hate to use the same word again, but very brave.
Yeah, no, and I think a lot of things this comic does is very brave in the way that, I mean, not only does it take the modernization, which is always risky, and the best example I can think of that's anything like this is that weird Romeo and Juliet movie with Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Okay, I love that movie.
Okay, I think...
Just put that out there.
But okay, I think that's exactly the same kind of thing, right? I like that movie too. I like it a lot. And I like it because it takes the original text pretty much verbatim and puts it into a new era. And this story takes almost exactly all of the same stories. There's so much in here that's references to the original text that would just go right past people who don't even know. When they're making the Neo Men, that prison, the book Mark Twain and his Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, where a guy from Yankee New York goes back in time to the days of Arthurian legend and creates a man factory. Like, that's a reference most people would never even think to get. You know? And it's just like, it's in here exactly as it would be, but in the year 3000. Like, the nuclear reactor, all this stuff. And that movie, I think it's the only thing I can think of that comes even close to doing the same kind of thing. And it's got that super polarizing effect. People are like, that's so stupid. They have guns instead of swords. I can't believe how dumb that is. But I think that's fucking awesome.
That movie definitely succeeded. It was very successful in putting a classical story into a modern setting, right?
No, yeah.
Without taking anything away from the original text. And I think that people get so hung up on the word classic that they feel like these things aren't open to interpretation. But, you know, if you really get down to it, like, a lot of stories are rehashing of the same ideas, not necessarily, you know, but everything's the same spin on it. Like Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey. You can apply that to so many different things.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about comics, there's a portion in Incredible Hercules where it follows Amadeus Cho, and the little narration bubbles are all excerpts from Hero's Journey. So that, you know.
That's really smart writing.
And it's about this, you know, Amadeus Cho's a Korean teenager who's super smart, and he's on the same type of journey as Hercules, the comic's namesake. And Hercules isn't even in the comic at this point. So it just goes to show you that if you open your mind up to new interpretations, then you can be entertained and enlightened by things like, I mean, this comic has a ridiculous title, right? Camelot 3000. That seems like an NES game.
Okay, am I the only one that when I read this, I think of the year 2000? I do Camelot 3000.
Conan O'Brien.
Yeah. Oh, yes, it's how I do it in my head every time I think about this comic.
Yep. So, just to kind of build off what David said, I also want to point out, like, anyone who might look at this and complain, like, oh, they're messing with the source material. Well, Thomas I'm doing that thing where the first name of the author just, like, left my head, and I hope I got it right, but
yeah,
Mallory.
Thomas Mallory, yeah.
Okay. He wasn't the original source. He was working largely off, I think, Chrétien de Troyes, who wrote in the French, and who took these stories from even older legends. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff, like, originated as folktale in Normandy, I think. So it's anyone who looks at this and says that it's disrespectful to the source or too silly, you know, we're not even playing off the original source material here.
Yeah, and you know what, though? I mean, if we want to talk about the tradition of King Arthur and Arthurian literature, I think the signature thing that happens with Arthurian literature, and, I mean, like David said, we were in a class together that I wrote the paper for this, but reading this again, I'm seeing something that I completely missed the first time I read it, like, 5 years ago. I think if I had to say there's any one signature thing about Arthurian literature, it's that the writers continually try to top each other. Mm-hmm. In that every time one writer's like, oh, man, I love this Arthurian stuff, I'm going to write my story. I'm going to have all the cool characters that I like, and I'm going to add a new knight to the round table. And my knight's going to be the most badass in this way. That's why, like, every time you read a story, there's this new knight that's more righteous or more rich or more awesome or kicks the most ass. Like, every time you read it, there's this new knight that's like, fuck yeah, I'm going to do the thing nobody else can do. And this follows in that tradition of taking the characters, the ones that the writer loves, making a cool story with them, building on the traditions that are already there, incorporating all the same old stories, and adding a new knight. I get Sir Thomas.
Yeah.
I love that.
And, you know, when the new knights are added, they're usually part of, like, getting your nationality in there. Like, Lancelot was added as part of, like, you know, let's represent the French. And then Percival came in to represent Germany.
Yeah.
So it's kind of neat that they're representing Britain again with the new guy, but it's Britain in the year 3000, so he's not just representing a country, but kind of like a time period.
Yeah, and it's great. I love the way that this builds on that tradition, because it'd be so easy to overlook those little kind of details, right? Because it's something that most people picking up this comic wouldn't give a crap about, you know? I'm sure there are people who pick up this comic and like, why is this Tom Schmuck still hanging around? Right? Because, I mean, seriously, he's like the most worthless of everybody there. He's like, I can pilot the ship. It's cool.
Well, what's neat is he just seems to, on the side, be some sort of medieval historian, too, right?
Yeah.
Because he's like an archaeologist or something.
But, like, as a hobby.
Yeah. So. Well, I think what he does is he gives the, like, an everyman kind of perspective. Because even the reborn knights, like Galahad and
Gawain. Galahad, Kay, Percival.
Is Gawain in this? Why did I?
Yeah, Gawain's in this.
He's the South African guy.
Yeah, the blank guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, all these guys are, they can remember their current life along with their original memories, right?
Mm-hmm.
But all of them, except for Guinevere, they all kind of snap into their new role. They get back to the way things were. You know, we have this Japanese Galahad, but he doesn't really...
Yeah, not a whole lot happens Japanese. With him.
So I think that, like, Sir Thomas gives the... He kind of represents the reader in the story. Do you know what I mean? He's like the... He's the narrator, I guess.
Yeah.
To a degree. So even though it's the year 3000, he represents teenage kids in 1982.
So, I mean, talking about 1982.
Oh, God.
I wasn't even alive then.
I wasn't either.
Me either. Oh, crap. But, like... This comic is so 80s, but it still holds up, I think.
Well, you know what, though? I think something being 80s has kind of a... Not really a negative connotation. I mean, it depends what perspective you're looking at it from, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of got a hipsterish vibe.
Nowadays, yeah.
that's so 80s, right? I don't think this is like... 80s, and it's like, oh man, this is cheesy. I mean, nobody's wearing, like, I don't know, I can't even think of anything. You know what I mean, right?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Wait, did you see Isolde's outfit?
Well, yeah, hers...
Wait, the one where she's the frilly neck thing and the puffy arms?
Uh-huh, and no pants and a mohawk.
The mohawk with the three braids.
Super 80s.
I don't know, though.
No, but I know what you mean. It's not... It's early 80s, so it's not like... Like the power, you know, like the power executive money 80s. It's not like American Psycho kind of thing going on yet.
Oh, this is what I mean. It's not groan inducing.
Yeah.
It wasn't, or at least it wasn't distracting. It wasn't so distracting that it mattered to me.
Yeah, and I know there are some stuff in here that really does make you want to scream, this is written by somebody in the 80s. Like, my favorite example is the rapiers. The rapier swords that shoot rays out of them.
Was it really spelled that way?
Yes, it was.
I think I saw it twice in there. R A Y for rays.
For that, lightsaber was already copyright by this time. Yeah. He couldn't use lightsaber. Yeah.
But I mean, there's stuff like that is super corny, but because the whole premise of the comic is corny, right? It doesn't feel out of place. You know, I mean, like, you pick up an 80s superhero comic and things feel corny because it feels out of place, because a lot of the same kind of superhero stories just are still retold today. They're just not recycled, but you get the same characters, especially now. The characters who died in the late 80s are being reborn, and that's basically the lineup that we have nowadays, you know. And so we see those characters doing 80s things in 80s comics, and that's what makes us groan, or at least me anyway, but that... Can't happen here. We're in the fucking year 3000. Well, it's corny to start with.
I think what it is when we see 80s comics that are based strictly in the 80s, and X-Men always comes to mind, you get, like, the pointy shoulders and the big hair and the neon, Like, I mean, look at Jubilee's outfit. It's so, like, 80s, 90s, right?
Yeah.
But here, this isn't actually... It's so 80s in that it's representative of 80s sci-fi. So you don't actually look at that and say, that's what my mom wore in 1983. You know? Like, you look at that and then you think, hey, Blade Runner, Total Recall.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're like, oh, man, the classics. And it's... It's more nostalgia than disgust, I think.
I actually, I'm flipping through the pages, and I came across a part that actually gave me pause about when, like, reminded me when this was written. And it's actually when we first meet the representatives of each country, like the president,
and then the
Chinese person, the so generic Soviet guy, and generic... African dictator. That was the only part that really, like, aged this for me. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I got towards the end, I think when they're all killed.
Yeah, when they're all getting assassinated, it gets super racist.
And I thought, you know, they could have just, like, guessed and picked some random countries, because who knows? We're still nearly 1,000 years from 3,000. Who knows? It could have been anybody, right?
Yeah.
But so that's it didn't really bother me, but I did pause and think about it a little bit.
Yeah, and you know, it dates it because it's a Soviet republic, right, which ends up falling in another couple years after this is printed. So it's not like, I mean, we can have that retrospect that they didn't know, and that at the time, you know, the Soviet Russia was still a superpower in the world.
Yeah, I mean, you know? it's over 1,000 years later. If you're going to assume the United States are still around, it doesn't hurt to assume.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think what dates it more for me was the racist depictions of these characters. Like, when Morgan Le Fay shows up in Rakma's room, Rakma just stops him and is like, hey, pretty lady, you want to hang out with me? Like, no, come on.
Yeah, that's pretty...
He's a dictator. He's not an idiot.
The worst one
was the Chinese leader. When Morgan Le Fay's, like, monkey thing comes in the room.
Are you a panda?
Are you some kind of panda? That was like, oh, no. Oh, did you really write that? Oh, God. You're racist for all time now. Oh, God.
You know what's weird, though? They have a lot of racial awareness in their depiction of... Oh, it's not Percival. It's not Galahad. It's Gawain.
Yeah.
South African, right?
Yeah.
Because he's African... He's black. This was during apartheid, right?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think so.
So that's actually like a really positive racial depiction of here is a black man in South Africa who is fighting for the good of the world in like this preeminent group of heroes. So, I mean, it strikes me as weird, the world leader stuff, because... I don't know, maybe the South African choice was just coincidental, but I feel like it wasn't. So it seems sensitive or like very aware in other ways.
Yeah, it's odd because the team is really diverse when you think about it. I mean, considering it's the 80s, you have a woman that's like a strong character on the team and a major driver of the plot for the protagonist, you know? Tristan is no small character. And yeah, you could say, well, fine, it's actually man inside or whatever, but that's still... That makes it even more of a big step, you know? And then in the end, you bring in the fact that she's transgender and homosexual and all this kind of stuff, and it's like, holy shitballs, you know? And you got Gawain, who's black, Galahad, who's Japanese. Like, all of this stuff that's, like, really progressive for the time.
Yeah.
It's surprising that the government stooges are like that.
Well, maybe it's to, you know, they're the villains, right? So maybe we're supposed to look at them in a... comical way.
Yeah.
Or not take them seriously. I mean, who knows, right?
So what did you guys think about the other villains? Le Fay and Modred.
The way that Modred was drawn up until he got the Grail armor, like, kind of bothered me.
Yeah.
Yes, he was drawn 80s. He had, like... Okay, he was drawn in the David Bowie outfits.
He was, like, super beautiful. It was so beautiful, it was, like, almost grotesque a little bit.
Right, and he had, like, the frilly cuffs and, like, the frilly shirt sometimes, and, like... Okay, so I think it was you, Jen, you put down in the notes that Tristan looks like a brunette David Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he... Modred is drawn the way, like, dressed the way David Bowie is.
I put down he's Billy Idol because of the hair.
Ooh, there you go. Perfect. And then you figure in like a 2,000 years where the time Le Fay could have found some more clothes.
Yeah, well,
she was on that space. Hey. She was on Planet X.
He's right, it is Planet X. I forget what they called it.
Planet.
But well, it's Planet X.
Charon, just like that planet that orbits Pluto.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was accurately named, I guess.
Just misplaced. So, what did you guys think of those two as the villains?
I want to point out an issue I had with Modred.
Okay.
And it was when he suddenly remembers what happens. Like, okay, this isn't an issue with him, but with his backstory. He suddenly remembers that, like, when he was a baby, a servant peasant girl took him to safety, but was waylaid by Arthur and Tristan. And then he just, like, dropped this line where he's like, oh, yeah, and Tristan raped her. And then no one ever talks about it again. It very well could have been in the original myth, because
I'm fairly sure that is in the original telling.
Well, they were raping everyone up in there.
That's true. That's true. These guys are depicted rather heroically in here, but you got to consider most of the source text, they're monsters and rapists.
But it just struck me as so weird. Like, even if you're just working from source material, why not leave that out, because you never address it? And it seems so strange that Modred would bring it up.
And
that he cared, you know?
And that scene really, I don't know. I get why Modred brings it up, because it's part of Modred's driving rationalization for why these guys need to die, is that, yeah, they look like heroes, but they're not really. You know, they're not really heroes. And, you know, maybe or not that happened. You got to consider this is also Modred's telling of the story. So you don't know how reliable of a narrator he is. Maybe that rape happened in the original. Maybe it didn't. I don't actually recall. I kind of want to think it did because everybody was raping everything back then. But,
yeah, I wouldn't put it past any of them.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it past any of these characters in the original. Well, I would put it past Kay. Kay wasn't really rapist. He was just an asshole.
I think Percival wasn't a rapist either.
No, he definitely.
He was the most pious of all the knights, I believe.
Yeah,
because he was the Grail Knight, right?
Yeah,
he was goofy too. He was a bumpkin.
Yeah, which is awesome. But I think you drop that scene in there. The reason it kind of jars you is because there's nothing else in this comic that fits that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think the writer's kind of trying to say, like, look, maybe these guys aren't good guys, but the problem is that's one page out of 250. The other 249 pages are like, fuck yeah, Knights of the Table Round! And that one's like, oh shit, he's a rapist. and then it never comes up again. And so it's like, that's why it feels jarring. And I think it's not emphasized enough maybe in the art that this is Modred's retelling.
All right, maybe
fulfill the frames or something.
All right, this is maybe a little bit of a stretch, but I'm gonna. Nah, never mind.
I'll say it.
Maybe that is why Tristan was resurrected as a woman.
Hmm.
Huh. So he can experience that side of the.
That's actually a really interesting idea.
That's like,
see, the problem with it is it's like a complete stretch because there's not really anything that points to that, except there are places in the comic where Tristan says, why am I being punished this way?
That's true. That link is never drawn for us, but to be fair, the narrator, the third-person narrator, is not very intrusive. It would make sense that he wouldn't bring that up. The narrator wouldn't bring that up. Huh.
That would actually tie a lot of stuff together, so I'm totally willing to make that stretch and just call it that in my mind.
Yeah, and that would rationalize why the scene is there, why the Higa never figures out why it's not brought up, why he learns tender love from his old.
Why he can only actually have a happy ending, because, you know, Tristan and Isolde is a tragic tale.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he gets a happy, like, they're together and it's true love, blah, blah, blah. They don't have to go and die or whatever. When he finally accepts that it's okay to be a lady.
Yeah.
Well, think about, like, all the things that happened to Tristan. I mean, the big focuses are, like, the part where he meets Morgan and she shows him shows her the reflection of her former self. But there's little bits in when they're in combat where people are like, oh, you know, Tristan's a lady now, so she's not totally reliable. But then there's places where she has to use the tools. That sounds kind of crude to say it that way. But she uses her... Okay, this is maybe a little bit... Now this isn't better. She uses her assets. And succeeds. And so Tristan learns that there's value. Maybe he learns the value of being a woman. And I think Guinevere tries to teach her that early on, and she just won't listen. And then, I don't know. That's the only connection I can think of why this would be put in here. And it's just one panel.
Yeah. It's wacky, though. I guess I'm kind of jumping around here, but Guinevere, her role of power is wholly ungendered, because they don't do the whole, well, she's queen and Arthur's so in love with her, therefore that's her source of power and control. They're like, oh yeah, she's commander of the Earth forces. She is the grand general of everything and the greatest warrior. So she's really come into her own as a fighter, and yet we have Tristan, who was always a fighter, and she's being told now, like, hey, use your cleavage.
Yeah, there are so many things about this comic that I want to praise the writer for doing with Tristan, and there are so many things that kind of make me cringe. Because there are some bits where it does get wildly sexist for no good reason. But then there are times when it's like, it's really, I'm going to use the word again, it's really brave, really exciting what he does with the character that I haven't seen in 30 years after this of comics.
Well, I mean, maybe the whole point is to show, is so you can, as you're going through it, you can see examples of all kinds of different human conditions and interactions, especially when it comes to gender roles and sexuality, right?
Yeah.
Because Tristan's at first completely against her position, and even at the end when it becomes a happy ending with Isolde, she's still not even comfortable in her own skin, right?
Yeah.
So, well, sorry, go ahead.
I know, I was just going to say, okay, so I feel like we kind of got to talk a little bit about Tristan, too. Just Jen put in, this whole thing gets really weird with Tristan wanting to be a dude. But I kind of think that, kind of, except for the sexist bits, as a dude, I can sort of, roundabout ways, think about why he/she is acting the way he/she is. Just in that, I mean, you got to figure, he's loved Isolde. That's the one that he's meant to love. And from his perspective, in the era that he's from, that's not possible with him as a woman. You know? But maybe the knowledge that he has from the 3000, from the year 3000, because it's a reincarnated character with memories of both, maybe that writes it off? I don't know. But, I mean, from the dude's perspective, I would be pissed.
So,
I like being a dude.
Go ahead, Jen.
Oh, just a comment on the weird comment I made. I actually wrote that about halfway through when we find out that Isolde is back. And it's not so much the transgender thing, because I think someone is bound to have a lot of conflicting emotions when they are actively remembering and knowing what it is to be dual-gendered. You know, you're going to be like, well, who am I? Got to figure this out. Don't have time because the Earth is getting attacked by aliens. What seemed weird to me was, not that even it was in here, but I was really worried when Isolde showed up about how they were going to deal with it and whether or not the ending, because I was certain he was going to end up with her, would be exploitive. I feel like it wasn't. So. Yeah.
No, I think it had a good ending. It's weird because most of the... For the, a good chunk of the comic, Tristan is working with this assumption that Isolde's not going to want him the way that he is in the female body. You know, it seems like he's just working on this assumption. And because he's still identifying himself primarily as a man, he can't accept Tom's advances. Like that scene where he just like, no, I know what the fuck you want to do. You want to touch my body. That's not going to happen. You know? He's like, I know why you're getting pervy. I'm a dude in here too. Don't you even try for that. Which, I don't know what that says about Tom either. But, you know, I'll put that aside. But I mean, it's, you can see the conflict in him. And eventually he gets over that at the same time that he gets around to his old. I don't know, apparently that thought just died, I guess.
Yeah, I was waiting for something else.
I think the interaction is really interesting, and I think anybody who wants to talk about the representation of transgender or bisexual characters in comics needs to read this.
Definitely.
It's interesting, you know, I was thinking right before we started recording, I was like, I wonder if this was news in the 80s. Because remember, like, a couple months ago when there was that issue of X-Men where Northstar marries his boyfriend?
Yeah.
And it was, like, news? And I was like, I understand why this is news, but what always upsets me when comics appear in the news is that it's like, nobody cares about comics 99% of the time.
Yeah.
And then when they're, you know, these American institutions that nobody seems to care about, you know, tries to do something progressive, it becomes a problem for people. I think I mentioned this before, like when Peter Parker dies and now there's a black Spider-Man. It's like, why do you people care all of a sudden? And so now that makes me wonder if this was news. Like, to me, I've been reading comics for a long time. Obviously, I wouldn't be doing the podcast if I hadn't. So when there's, like, homosexual characters in comics, it doesn't mean anything to me. It's like, okay, this is the character. These comics are supposed... Comics, a good comic to me, reflects our world, right? And there's gay people, so why wouldn't there be gay superheroes, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the worst culprit of it last year, too, was DC, when they said... One of the main characters of the DC universe is gay.
What?
In the new reboot, he's gay. And it turns out it's Alan Scott, and he has a gay partner who dies in the first issue.
You know what? Like, that... Never mind. I was like, but Alan Scott's son was gay. Why couldn't you just bring his son back?
Right. And that's what pissed me off, because Alan Scott in the new DCU doesn't have a gay son anymore. He doesn't have the son.
Yeah.
So they took out one gay character and put in another gay character, and you have the same number of gay characters. Like, nothing controversial happened at all.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
It's like you had a perfectly good character already.
The most controversial thing is that maybe you could say over the last 15 years of comics, we've gone from putting women in refrigerators to putting boyfriends in refrigerators.
Oh, God.
Right? But no, seriously, it's essentially the exact same thing, but with a male character. And all they've done...
The refrigerator.
Doesn't put him in a refrigerator, but... Literally, the trope is that the female character has to die to inspire the male character to action. And all they've done is said, well, the male boyfriend has to die in order for the male character to be motivated to action. Which, it's the exact same trope, just you've done it with a gay guy instead of a woman. And we can call that progressive, but, I mean, over the 15 years, you'd think something more would have happened.
Nope. You know, I was just flipping through the comic, and I kind of want to go back and rehash what we were saying about Arthur making Tristan use her assets to trick the guards. And remember, he actually did that to shame her.
Yeah.
And that was weird, because on the one hand, it's kind of like saying, well, look, we all know that women's bodies aren't meant to be used like this. On the other hand, it's kind of like... You know, use your body in a way that offends and shames you to prove your loyalty to me. That's really weird. I don't know.
I mean, on the one hand, I can kind of understand that, because this entire comic, I mean, not understand it in that it's rationalized, but from Arthur's perspective, this comic spans a time span of what? 2 weeks? Say 2 weeks? It sounds about right, right?
Maybe yeah, a month? Pretty fast.
And there's like two or three people that betray him in that 2 month period? Like at the outset, you're going to say 2 months? Two weeks. Three people betray him in 2 weeks. Three or four. I lose count. Like, if I'm Arthur, I'm going to be doing a lot of subtle tests of my knights. And before Tristan goes up and figures out how easy these guards are to defeat, Tristan thinks, okay, yeah, we need to keep quiet. We don't want to alarm the other guards. Like, it makes sense that she would be the one to go out there. Now, obviously, he can't send Guinevere. That's the queen. You can't do that.
Well, another thing, too, I mean, I don't think it was right for him to shame her.
Yeah.
But she's also very, she has no confidence in her abilities as a knight because she doesn't think that a woman could be a skilled warrior. Even though there's an example standing right next to her. And so Arthur puts her in a position where not only does she have to use her feminine wiles, but she just then has to kick these guards' asses. She has to kick this dude's ass, right? And she does it with her own skill as a fighter. Mm-hmm. So,
go ahead. I think I'm going to say the words you're going to say.
Yeah, I think so. So maybe it does two things, right? It tests the loyalty, and it also says, "See, you're still an ass kicker. It doesn't matter who you are."
Maybe it's a way to make her reconcile the fact. Okay, yes, you are a woman. Go up there. Yes, see, you're a woman. Show everybody you're a woman, and then kick their fucking ass anyway. And whether or not the way that he does it is right, whether or not the rationalization. The entire thing could be wrong to do, but at least the motivation's kind of good. If that's the actual motivation, I don't know, but even the motivation, I don't know if Arthur's motivation there is good.
Well, Arthur's also like a time-lost bumpkin, right? He has no concept of women's lib or anything like that. So
that's true.
Maybe he's just dumb.
That's true. Of everybody on the cover, he's the one who is out of time. Everybody else is from the year 3000. Every last one is the one. That's what makes it so weird that Tristan can't reconcile it. You'd think in another 1,000 years, excuse me, 88 years from now, we'd have been able to figure this out.
Okay. Well, the thing, too, is like, right, I mean, she's thrust into the most unfamiliar situation, right? Like, yeah. So Gawain is now an African, he's a South African dude.
Yeah.
But he's still a man, right?
Yeah.
And Galahad's a Japanese guy. But he's a samurai, right? So he's still a badass warrior.
Yeah.
So they probably get over their new forms pretty quickly. But Tristan is like, what the fuck is going on?
What the fuck are these?
He can't get over. It's like, it's such a mind-blowing change for her. That she can't get over it.
Yeah, and
Arthur has to be a good leader in his backwards way and say, look, you're still Tristan. Be a knight. Do it. You're going to do it.
Do it. Do it now. No, I think you bring up a good point in that the rest of these knights, even though they're modernized, are a lot like the original characters. I mean, Galahad, the Japanese guy, in the original text, Galahad's the most honorable of the knights. That's who he is. So, of course, when you see him, he's going to, you know, it's a little bit racist, but he's going to be trying to commit seppuku because he couldn't serve his master properly. You know, but, like, throughout this comic, Galahad is concerned with honor, and Gawain is the knight of the earth, but in this comic, there is no earth. And, like, the idea of earth and your roots and your connection to the land is portrayed here through family, I think. So that's very true to the same there. I mean, Lancelot of the Lake was like the richest, most beautiful, most generous knight. And here we get the same thing. The guy is like taking on refugees, saving people. He's from an area that's nowhere near the knights. He's coming, like, he is a French character coming to England from France. Like, he's coming from far away. And here he has a fucking space station, you know? And a lot of these characters, I mean, even Kay is very similar. He's an asshole in the past. He's an asshole now. I mean, that's really the only update there. The other one I really like is Percival. Percival's the penitent man. In all the comics, he's the bumpkin. He's the dumb, strong kid. Like, he's the guy that's strong because he's the most righteous with God, so he's strong through that. But other than that, he's some fucking stupid lumbering oaf. Hey, look at this! He's a mute lumbering oaf! You know, like, these are really accurate modernizations of the characters, except for Tristan. Which, of course, makes him part of the focus. And I love that the way that all of them are modernized like that. Guinevere's changed a little bit. She's made a lot stronger of a character. Okay, and did you guys, when they were calling her Commander, were you reading that her name was Commander Action?
It took me a second. The first time I saw it, I was like, wait a minute. And then I was like, okay.
Dude, it's Acton. It totally took me until the 12th issue to realize that I was reading it wrong. I was like, man, Guinevere's badass. They call her Captain Action. Get out there and kick some ass, Captain Action. Or Commander Action. But I like that with these characters, and I think this is the theme for them, there's a constant theme of sacrifice with all of these knights. They're all sacrificing something, and I really, really like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice way to frame their loyalty, because you don't have much time to build it, right? When you read Arthurian legend, it's like these dudes have known each other for years and years and years, and anytime someone new comes in, they have to go on a quest to prove their worth, and we don't have time for that in a 12-issue comic.
Nope.
So to show them, instead of just saying like, oh, yeah, they did know each other, but then they've been reincarnated and suddenly remembered, you can actually have them actively show that they're willing to give up a lot for each other. And that shows that they are still the people they were in the legends, and really strengthens that character bond between them.
Yeah. Well, there's a few other themes I want to bring up that were in the original. So, like, in Arthurian, there's a couple consistent Arthurian themes that are represented here. And the one that I think I like best that you find is might makes right. That's like a theme of all of the Arthurian literature. The strongest guy is the one who can kick the most ass, and he's the one who will win. And he's the one who will who history will say is in the righteous path. And I think we get that here a little bit.
I think we definitely do. I mean, especially in issue number 2 when Arthur shows up at the UN. Because there's the Neo-Men are starting to try to disperse the crowd. He grabs the dude by the belt and he goes all Captain Kirk on him with the two-handed punch thing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, then he goes into the General Assembly and does the quintessential Queen Arthur action and pulls a sword out of the stone that nobody else is able to. And it's like, okay, this dude's the strongest, clearly.
Yeah, and you know what makes that scene interesting is that he does that huge display of strength when you have to consider, right before that, the UN was saying, we're officially going to sanction against these aliens, we sent a diplomat and he got killed, we're going to send another diplomat to send... Like, they were exploring diplomatic, peaceful options. And Arthur comes in and says, let's kick some ass!
Well, even the narrator says that that's what Arthur's thinking. You know, he says... Now he is king, and he knows the value of appearance. He wants to shout, to exclaim for the whole again. Well, then it says something. Okay, that doesn't... Never mind. But basically, he's like, look how badass I am by pulling the sword out and, like, wielding it above his head.
Yeah, he basically strolls in there, a warmonger, and aiming to undermine the powers of everybody else in the room, and saying, well, hey, all you limp dicks, I'm the one that pulled the sword from the stone. Fuck all you guys. And then Storm walks out. He, like, drops the mic and walks out. You know? And it's like, we get the depiction of him as being the good guy, and certainly he does save the world, but you gotta consider, like, morally speaking, I don't know.
Well, it's funny because it shows the people watching from the TVs at home, and all of a sudden, they're, like, hugging and stuff and shaking hands, like, now we're about to kick these green dudes' ass because we got this old-timer guy.
with fucking chainmail.
Chainmail, magic sword, and a gun tucked into his belt.
It's amazing. Everybody immediately loves and trusts him and is just like, yeah. And there's no one who is, like, at all suspicious that he might be some sort of fraud or that, like, he can't take on aliens. It's pretty impressive.
You know what's funny? We don't see anyone else try to take the sword from the stone. There's, like, those little... There's, like, the some guys on little hover chairs that are...
Yeah, they're, like, trying to cut it out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. We don't see anybody else even try. You figure there's a room for the world leaders.
It's kind of like everyone knows Arthur's back, and that's the big deal. But it just strikes me as really odd that not a single person was like, hey, wait a minute, you've been dead for 3,000 years.
I know, right?
Maybe everybody's, like, totally familiar with their Arthurian legend. They're like, dude, he's just sleeping in Avalon. Don't even trip. He's been asleep the whole time.
Yep, future king, man. Future king.
The future is now.
So I want to say the other theme from Arthurian legends is...
Sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I just get the feeling we're going to run along. Is that bored jocks make trouble for themselves, which is a theme through the classic Arthurian literature. You got to figure knights were jocks of their time, right? They were big. They were strong. They wore the armor. They went out and kicked the ass. They come back. God. You're farming the field. You little nerdy bitch. I'm going to go out and kick some more ass and get some more field for you to plow. Right? And when there's nobody's ass to kick, they're just going to hang around and make trouble. And it seems like half of the trouble that happens for Arthur is when they're, like, engaging in revelry or just hanging out. They're not even fighting anybody. Like, Galahad and Gawain are hanging out, like, saying, man, somebody should do something. They're, like... getting wasted, almost inciting, like, mutiny, sitting there talking until they get too drunk to actually do it.
Yeah, they're drinking and arm wrestling.
Yeah, and then, like...
Wrestling.
And then Tristan is talking with Morgan, and, of course, Kay being Kay is perving around the place and listens, and he causes fucking... He stirs up some shit. You know, it's like half the problems in this are self-inflicted. Yeah.
This is a little bit of a side, but speaking of Arthurian legend and jocks, do you guys remember the cartoon from the 90s, King Arthur and the Knights of Justice?
Yeah.
Yes.
They were straight up a football team that became the Knights of the Round Table because their bus had a magical crash.
Yep.
So, and the quarterback was, of course, King Arthur.
Of course. Who else?
Of course.
Yeah.
You're not going to watch that again.
Somehow I don't think that cartoon has aged as well as this comic.
Don't think it would hold up?
No,
I don't
know. Not going to happen.
Mm-mm. Aren't they from almost the same time period?
No, I think the cartoon's from the 90s.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's fine.
Just popped in my head when we were talking about jocks.
It's relevant-ish.
I think I talked about it in my paper in that class. I think I brought up King Arthur.
You did. Wait, Jen, you were just going to say something.
Oh, I just was going to move us on. sorry. I want to talk about the Lancelot Guinevere Arthur love triangle, because feel like that needs addressing. What did we think of this incarnation of it?
I really liked this incarnation of it. I like that Merlin's like, look, you guys aren't married yet. She's not doing nothing wrong. She's just out there being Commander Action, and he's rich French dude whose name I forgot. Oh, Futurel, I think
Futurel,
it is.
Futurel, yeah. Jacques Futurel.
Jacques Futurel and Commander Action are just out there making out. Like, sorry, King Arthur, these are not the same people. They might have the same personalities, but it's a different body, you know? And I really like Lancelot's explanation to Tom. I really like that scene. Because when you read Arthurian literature, there's never an explanation for why, other than deep, passionate love, you know, or like, what's the other phrase? Courtly love, like this higher standard of love where you have to do all this playing around stuff around court and whatever the fuck. Like, but you never hear Lancelot say, like, everybody around knows Lancelot knows he's doing something wrong, and he never gives an explanation of why he's doing it. Like, Lancelot's not a fucking idiot. He knows what he's doing. And I love that here he takes the time and tells Tom straight out, this is why I can't help myself.
Yeah, and it just seems like a far more adult or like mature version of the love, too. Because, you know, in the original version, they love each other, but it's childish and selfish, and they put like a whole kingdom at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And here, you see that Guinevere and Lancelot have grown out of that, and Arthur does it over the course, because at first he's like, well, you know, Merlin says they're not doing anything wrong. He's like, then I have to marry her to make it wrong. And he's just like, you don't get a choice.
Yeah.
But then he realizes how stupid that was, and he's like, you know, he doesn't really say I shouldn't have done that, but he says I forgive you. And I think that's pretty big.
Yeah, except he's also, throughout the comic, he's kind of a dick about it. He really is. I mean, of course you're going to be a dick about it. She cheats on him twice in two lifetimes. But he is, I don't want to say he's asking for the ire of the reader or the ire of these characters. But he's like, oh, well, it's not wrong. Well, fuck, you're marrying me in 2 days because I am the king and I get to pick my wife. So you don't get no damn choice in this, little Gwen, honey. You know, he does that. And then, like, for the short, brief time that they're married, it's really subtle, but he makes stabs at Lancelot. Like, they'll be flying back in the jet from some adventure, and he says, well, it's time to go home and relax, if you know what I mean. And he looks like his vision is down at Gwen's chest. You know? And, like, you can see Lancelot in the foreground, like, almost frowning, but not, like, really, like, not characterization kind of, like, super sad face, but he's, like, obviously uncomfortable. Because it's the three of them. It's the three of them in the jet. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to go home and fuck her. You know?
It's awkward.
It's super awkward. And it's a dick move. Like, they all know it. And he's the one who's being the asshole about it. And it's almost that, like, sure, Lancelot is the one who's asking her to cheat. Lancelot is the one who's pulling her away if you want to remove her freedom of choice and remove her as an active agent in the story. Then he's the one who pulls her away, but he's the one who doesn't come off like a dick. And then after she ends up showing up in his room naked and Arthur, you know, Kool-Aid smashes the wall in and catches them. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Like, after he catches them, if you notice, he doesn't call her Guinevere after that.
Yep, mm-hmm. She's Captain Action.
Captain Action for the rest of the comic. You cheated on me, you're not Gwen. You are not the person I knew then. You would not do this to me twice. And it's like, there's subtle stuff in there all the way through that makes you think, yeah, what she did and what Lancelot did was wrong, but the one who's being a big baby about it is Arthur. Which, I mean, you can kind of say he has the right to, but
yeah, maybe he's not expressing himself in a healthy way, but I wouldn't say he's in the wrong.
No, I don't think so either.
He's obviously going about it, like, really poorly, because you can't make someone choose you like that. But on the other hand, like, it's totally natural to have a very, very strong dislike of whoever is with the person you like. Hmm. Like, even if you took out the cheating, or before they got married, you know, and it's actually kind of big of him to be like, yeah, I trust you in terms of nightly duties. Wait, that came out like, I can't make this not a pun. I trust you as a knight of the round table, Lancelot.
Yeah.
So that's like kind of big of him, because seriously, if you are in love with someone and they're with someone else, you are very likely to view that person as like horrible and you hate them and, you know, you just want to get rid of them. And he doesn't. He's friends, so.
Yeah, I mean, they were BFFs before Guinevere entered the picture, they were before Guinevere entered the picture for Lancelot, before it became a problem. They were like, you know how there's love at first sight? Like, they were BFFs at first sight.
They were bros.
Yeah. They really were. They were the definition of a bromance. They were the original bromance, these two.
And it's, I don't know, it's a kind of, it's a testament to the strength of the round table that for the longest time, you know, Arthur and Lancelot are able to remain bros through that. And it's, you know, it pushes really far till it hits the breaking point.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's one of the other Arthurian themes that are in this. And this theme is, like, from way back in the 80s, you know, and way the fuck back from the original, too, is that bromances are better than romances. Because two romances in here? One of them fails utterly. The other one is stricken with all these fucking problems. Like, Tristan and Isolde have all these fucking problems, and the love triangle is a big fucking pain in the ass. But throughout it, like, the relationships that hold strong beginning to end are the bromances. Kay and Arthur, Gawain and Galahad, and they're drinking and they're thinking alike, you know. Percival and Tom are friends. Like, the bonds in here are really strong between the dudes and not so much in the love interest part of the story. And it's just interesting that the writer, I don't know if he chose to carry that on, but it carries on in here.
Well, you're right, it is. Like, what is it? In Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, bros before hoes. Percival, the first time I think he comes to the Grail, it's not just that he's not pure enough. It's once again, he chose a hoe before his bro.
Yep.
And couldn't get the Grail. And he had to learn that that's not the way things work. So, obviously, it's the way God intended it.
That's the 11th commandment, bros before hoes, apparently.
That's right.
So, the last thing I think we can talk about is the art. What did you guys think of the art in this?
I thought it was pretty solid 80s art. I mean, I don't mean to say that in, like, a negative connotation, but it's really solid art for the time, you know? I think there's good detail, and the coloring is pretty good. I don't know. I didn't like the design of the bad aliens.
Yeah. The costume design and the character design was a little bit off, I think.
It's camp where it's so bad it's good. Like, I didn't have a problem with the art, but I found some things so ridiculous, like overwrought facial expressions, especially Lancelot has a few.
Yeah.
He makes some weird faces in there.
Yeah.
And they're not anatomically incorrect or, like, wrong or anything. It's just, like, goofy. And, God, Morgan Le Fay's costume. I look at those freaking pearls and I'm like, those are made of plastic. I can't help think otherwise. And it's just, it's ultimate camp, but not in a bad way.
Yeah. And I do want to say, in terms of drawing the female characters, the costume for Morgan Le Fay is a really poor choice. But I think the really good choice was that none of these characters, the only one that's ever drawn in the super sexy poses is Nineveh, which for her character makes perfect sense. She's the siren, right? Yeah. She's the one who will be drawing the super sexy poses. And Morgan Le Fay too, because she wants to use her body as a tool. And she doesn't in this comic, but that's part of her character and that's part of who she is, and she hasn't been able to get that out of her system. That makes sense there too. But the rest of them aren't usually drawn in the super sexy poses, and besides that, they're not really drawn with awkward proportions either. I mean, you get that scene where, sure, Tristan uses her assets, but I mean, from an artist's perspective and from a writer's perspective, it'd be so easy to make that scene so much more believable if she had, like, double D's. You know? Just in terms of, like, writing comics, right? And you have to convey information visually. You want to convince the reader on first glance that the sexy wiles are going to work, right? Give all of them big breasts. But nobody in this is, like, comically huge. Nobody in this is today's comic books.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just agreeing with you.
No, yeah, and I was just going to say yeah and then trail off.
Well, that worked. Yeah, I mean, we never see Guinevere in compromising poses. She's in weird space queen outfits all the freaking time. But she doesn't do anything super sketch in those outfits.
Yeah, if anything, she has the commander action dominating poses. She might be wearing a dress, but she's got those poses, same poses as Arthur gets. I think that's really interesting for a comic that's 30 years old.
Yeah, this comic is so oddly forward in some ways and so oddly backwards in others, and the art reflects that pretty accurately, too.
The other thing, the last thing I want to say about the art is the frame layout and the page layout, the way that works in here. I really, really like it, because when action is moving, you get tight frames, you get quick movement, but then when that momentous scene hits, when it lands on the page, it's at least a half a page.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, you get, like, all this stuff, them talking, mulling back and forth over in the jet, but then when they land, King Arthur, like, strides out of it like a fucking badass with his cape blowing in the wind. He's gonna wreak havoc on this fucking Planet X, you know? Or you get the tight action, we gotta get Excalibur back. Okay, let's go to this nuclear plant. Nuclear plants are this, and they had to take down the forest, and that's why there's not a real lake here, and blah, blah, blah. Then fucking Sword is on the whole page, and it's fucking sick because it's Excalibur. Right? Like, it does a really good job of keeping action and information in small frames just as big as it needs to be, but when the right moment explodes in front of you, when you need that depth of field, when you need that feeling of the awesomeness of the moment, that kickassery that's about to happen, or that just happened, it does a really good job of transitioning right into that moment really, really naturally.
Yeah, or I just want to, like, cite a favorite scene. After King Arthur learns of the atom bomb, he decides to split an atom using Excalibur.
Yeah.
And, like, they actually had, like, a really cool concept where it shows you the mushroom cloud and then kind of, you know, you may be wondering, in case you didn't get what just happened, that he turned a rock into a bomb. You see, like, this weird little square frame spiraling off, and I think it had like a little depiction of an atom in it, and it was just like, that's really clever and a good way to depict action that's not like action. It's not taking place in a long span of time. It just happened, but then we see it expanded.
Yeah, you see that moment happening, like the nanosecond to nanosecond as it spirals into the explosion. And I really, really love the page after that, where it's got like the big cross of the explosion, and it shows you the Castle Lefebvre blowing up, and it shows you the Grail turning to dust, and there's a small frame at the bottom of Lancelot sort of peacefully smiling in death. Like, sure, he failed to get the Grail back, but his quest is finished. He has guarded the Grail to the end of its existence. And nobody can use it again for evil. Like, that page, it's just a full page spread, and it's just a really awesome depiction of cool explosion, badassery, everything is one, go! It's really cool. I really like that. So I guess the final thing to talk about then, if you guys don't have anything else?
No.
No.
Is the last page with Alien Arthur.
Oh, man. Hmm.
I like it. Do you guys?
I think it's cool.
Can't decide. It was a little, like, goofy, but at the same time, why not? Because he reincarnated in the year 3000.
Yeah, I think it's cool. I don't think it was necessary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think so either, but I think it's a good modernization again on the idea that Arthur will be where he's needed to do what's needed of him in the time that he's there. You know, the same way that England needs him now, so he rises again. Alien planet whatever needs him now, so he will rise.
You know, I think it killed closure for me, because when Mallory's story ends, England is in strife and, you know, they have to put Excalibur back in the lake and, you know, like, everyone's kind of fucked up in some major way. And here, all of that's resolved. Guinevere and Lancelot are allowed to be happily ever after together. Percival finally found the Grail and became his human self. Let's see, Tristan and Isolde actually wind up together. Arthur saves England once and for all and doesn't fall on the battlefield in a way that hurts his country. So I kind of feel like, just, you know, you wrapped up the story so beautifully. Why you gotta start over with the tension or unhappiness or strife?
Yeah, right when you finally get ultimate closure for all of these thousands of year old stories. It's just mull it under again. Yeah. I don't know. I think it's an interesting risk to take, because I think David's right. It's you could easily leave it out. It's not necessary. I mean, from an editorial standpoint, like, it doesn't add to the story. I don't think. It just gives you that extra idea that he will come again somewhere.
Yeah. It's just like legends never die kind of thing. Right?
Yep. All right. You guys want to rate this?
Sure.
All right. David, you go first.
All right. I'm gonna give this a 4. I actually like this comic a lot. I remember reading it after you wrote your paper, Andy, you lent me your trade, and I liked it then, and now that I kind of, like, I've been removed from, because we had been reading Arthurian stuff for months,
a lot. Yeah.
And I was kind of, like, burnt out on it, and I was like, hey, look at how silly this is, these guys are in the year 3000, who'd have thunk it? But now, especially after we've been talking about comics so much and the different types of ways you can succeed, you can tell a good story with comics and talk about real, so like, real issues and things. I'm surprised, like, how, like, the type of things that were tackled in this comic and the ways in which they were presented. I think we used to brave a lot in this whole episode, but it was really thoughtful, I think. Maybe because we're 30 years after the fact, but, you know, I think that it was still pretty smart. Like, there's some things we think we kind of cringe at, but I think all in all, this was a very thoughtful and considerate tackling of a lot of the issues, especially the, you know, Tristan's whole experience through these 12 issues. I think the art's good. I think it's very true. It's true in the right ways without overdoing it to the original source material. So yeah, I think if you like Arthurian legends or you just like comics, I think this is a really good example of how, you know, comics even back in the 80s were doing something really, really well, or some doing good work. That kind of ended on a whimper, but yeah, I'm going to give it a 4.
All right, how about you, Jen?
The more I think about this, the more I like it. So I'm gonna call it a 4.5. And having read a lot of medieval literature, like you guys, it's I feel like it took a pretty respectful tone towards the original source material for something so campy. But then I think back, and I look at the original source material, and I think, like, there's a scene in Mallory, for instance, where some dude eats a poison apple and then, like, he dies, and on his tombstone or some, like, engraving, they write, like, here lies such and such, he ate an apple and then he brast, which is the Middle English term for burst. Like, he ate an apple and exploded. How campy is that? Or, freaking Parzival by Wolfram von Eschenbach. Like, I know, like, it's totally off topic, but I just want to bring up these camp issues. Like, Parzival has a half-brother who is half black and half white, and people, I guess, didn't know how genetics worked or anything, because he's spotted like a cow.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, you know, this is not very far from the source material, and that's amazing, because it's 1983, and that just blows my mind. Like, you have the same sort of wackiness. And I think maybe I'm having, like, I live in the future and therefore I'm pretentious issues. I don't know. But it's just, there's a lot of humor and a lot of goofiness in actual Arthurian legend, and this carries it through. And on the cover of every issue, they say, like, a continuation of the story as told by Mallory. And then, you know, it really is in tone and topic. So I gotta say, like, you know, I think I said everything I wanted to about Tristan and, you know, Guinevere and the way they dealt with modern issues, but I'm pretty impressed. So 4.5.
All right. I'm going to lay down the 5.0. Ooh. I'm going to do it. Because, I mean, we can talk about how this comic was progressive for the time. I mean, it's 30 years later. We don't deal, in comics, we don't deal with sex and relationships. Sex and healthy relationships. We deal with rape just fine in comics nowadays for some reason. They'll drop rape whenever, but they don't drop healthy sex and portrayal of sex within relationships and love triangles in a way that's realistic or healthy. And here you get sex between characters and resolution of those relationships. By the end, Arthur calls Guinevere Guinevere again. Like, he comes around and is like, fine, okay, I forgive you. I forgive you, Lancelot. I understand your passion. And now I must go and save the galaxy. You know? And the way that you get righteous murder here, too. And that you can kill these aliens. And sure, you can say generic enemy like Nazis, okay to kill them or whatever. But then you find out they're not all generic Nazis. These are dudes who are just under Lefay's control. You know? And you get her being insanely brutal, making them tear off their own limbs and sacrifice their lives to build a friggin' cart for her to ride on. You know, you get these characters having sacrifice, not just in Tristan being a woman, but like Kay straight up saying, I'm going to take the fall for everybody because that's my job. Or Percival being fine, being the monster. You know, and what you said, Jen, about how this following in the grand tradition of Arthurian literature, I think this follows every single tradition that what we consider classics to follow. Even better than modern renditions. I mean, people nowadays look at, say, Mists of Avalon as a great continuation of the tradition, but I don't think so. I think that's just a rewriting of the old tradition in a modern bent. And that's wonderful, but it doesn't continue anything. It just tells the same story. This does what the tradition tells you to do. It tells you, take the story for granted, make modifications where you need to, and build on it. And this takes the original story and just builds on it even more. But I think primarily the reason I want to give this a 5.0 is because every time we come across a comic that the three of us universally like, we always end up having a short episode. Because we, for whatever reason, can't see much more than, this is great, this is wonderful, I love this, look at how it does this good, and this is great. And I mean, this is something we universally loved, and we still managed to talk for it about a fucking, like, hour and a half. And talked about the meatiness of it and talked about the things that it does well and the things that it conquers and the ways in which it tries to tackle certain subjects and the way it approaches conflicts of character, like with Tristan being a woman now versus raping women in the past. Like, these hefty themes, and we can sit here and chew on them because this comic, even though it's universally loved, is good enough to support that kind of discussion where it doesn't have just, like, what's another one that we all loved? Like V for Vendetta. V for Vendetta just says, this is my theme, this is my moral, I am to teach you, and so here it is, splayed out over 1,000 pages of crappy art. Go. Well, not crappy art, crappy coloring. Go, this is my story, learn my moral, I am to teach you, that I need 1,000 pages to teach you. And at the end you can say, well, the moral of the story is obviously this, and there's hints of these other themes, and that's wonderful, great, and you're done talking about it in 15 minutes. I feel like we could talk about this comic, little scenes in this, for like another hour.
There's a lot here.
Yeah. You know? And for a 12-issue comic, that's a hell of an achievement. And, I mean, giving this a 5 and talking about it for an hour and a half makes me go back and want to rethink the other 5s I gave. You know, like, I think this sets a new bar for me for these comics. And, of course, I told everybody in the beginning that I was predetermined to like this comic a lot, but the more we sat and talked about it, I realized that that's why I want to give it a 5, for no other reason. For all the other things we've given 5s, this seems to be the one that, like, I've had the most sticking to my teeth after we were done. Like, I still could say this, but we're at an hour and 20 minutes and I gotta wrap up. So yeah, I'm giving this motherfucker a 5. Bam. So next week, we will be reading Conan, Volume 1, The Frost Giant's Daughter, and Other Stories. This is written by Kurt Busiek. If you want more information about that trade, if you want to link directly to it on Amazon, I would suggest not trying the individual issues, or if you want to, go to your comic book retailer and have them help you. Conan has a history of multiple reboots by multiple writers. Kurt Busiek is considered to be the guy who picks up the tradition of the original and does a good story, does a good telling of Conan with modern writing and modern art. So we're going to go with his first volume, but it's Frost Giant's Daughter and Other Stories. But if you want more information, go to the website, www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. Click on Future Shows, and then there will be an Amazon link directly to the exact volume that we are going to be reading. So that's the website. If you want to ask us in person exactly the issues we're reading, in case the Amazon's a little bit ambiguous for you, if you just want to email us and say hi, you can hit us up over email, which is...
AtomicPoweredSupercast@gmail.com.
Every time you pick up the email, Jen, when I drop it, I get this hint in the back of my head that she's so tired of saying iTunes from the first 100 episodes when that's the only thing she ever said in the outro.
No, I like saying iTunes. Okay. I do.
Okay. So yeah, speaking of iTunes, please subscribe to us there. It helps us know how many of you are listening, and rate us and say how great you like listening to us.
iTunes!
Yeah.
Yeah.
And please follow us on the social medias, which are...
That would be on Twitter at twitter.com/APSupercast or facebook.com/APSupercast.
Yeah, so that's all the ways to get a hold of us. Drop a line and say hey. We're trying, really are trying, to post more stuff on our Facebook page.
So yeah, check it out. There's some interesting things up there.
Yeah, links to fun stuff I find on DeviantArt, things from Tumblr. I don't know, just things we find that we like, just throwing up there and... comment, just look at it, whatever. Go and have fun. Speaking of fun, hopefully you will listen again next week. Until then, everybody, goodbye.
Bye.